listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Welcome to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. And we're broadcasting live tonight from the Heritage Radio Mega Studio behind Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. So one of my students yesterday, you know, I teach at a culinary school. I've mentioned that. Yesterday, one of my students came in and she was telling me this story about something that had happened to her that morning. She wanted to get an iced coffee. Makes sense. Summer, New York. But, you know, she's a student on a budget, so she decided she would skip Starbucks and that sort of price point and go to McDonald's. They sell coffee. They sell iced coffee. I've had it. It's not bad, actually. So she goes in. She tells the guy behind the counter that she wants a large iced coffee with milk. And he just looks at her for a while, and then he says, "What flavor?" And she looks back at him, and she says, "Coffee flavor?" And he just looks back at her again, kind of uncomprehendingly, and says, "No, what flavor iced coffee do you want?" And so she said it again, "I just want coffee flavored iced coffee." And then they kind of reached an impasse, and there was silence, and they were just looking at each other. And then the counter guy said to her, "Hazelnut, caramel, or mocha?" And her boyfriend, who was with her, then figured out that what was going on was that there is no such thing as plain iced coffee. Apparently, everybody has it flavored. And so he said, "Plain. She wants it plain. A plain iced coffee. No flavor. Just coffee flavor. Just plain." So the guy looks at them again and he goes, "Oh, so you want vanilla?" So she told me this, and we started to commiserate about that. What happened to just drinking coffee? Why does everything have to be sort of enhanced, value added? Why does saying just coffee mean you have to specify plain, unflavored? I don't want any like chemically synthesized faux hazelnut in my coffee. I hate flavored coffee. Why should I have to be the one to modify the way I want my coffee served? Because now flavored is the norm. And you have to specify otherwise. Why do we add these like sugary syrups to what is on its own a perfectly good flavor? Do we need like that much variation and that much diversity in everything? Does everything have to have spin-off flavors? Do we have to have 12 different kinds of M&Ms? Can't we just eat the regular M&Ms? Is nothing sacred anymore? And now, like, even more frustratingly, that what happened with them when she said she wanted plain, he assumed she wanted vanilla. Like, vanilla is the default equivalent to plain. I don't want flavor. I want vanilla. Well, if vanilla is added to something, then it's vanilla flavored, not plain flavored. Plain implies nothing else added. Vanilla isn't nothing. It's something great on its own, and it deserves its own top billing. But it's like when something is described as vanilla, you know, like vanilla sex, people say that. It implies plainness, lack of excitement, you know, very boring, flat. Now, if I were a vanilla bean or a vanilla orchid, I'd be really insulted by that, because it's actually one of the most exotic plants in the world and one of the most fascinating. And it's hard to be a vanilla bean. You have to live in really faraway places, and you only get laid one night of the year, basically. I almost said the week, but one night a year that vanilla orchid is pollinated. One night a year, that's their only chance for any sex. So that's pretty intense. You have to be fermented in order to develop your flavor. There's a lot to it, but we're going to get more to that later. More about that later. When I was in fourth grade, we were learning about opposites in class, and we were all calling out examples to the teacher for her to write on the board of what we, you know, gave as examples of opposites. So, you know, up, down, back, front, right, left, things like that, black and white. And then somebody called out salt and pepper. And my teacher, I can't remember her name at this point, corrected them to say, no, it wasn't salt and pepper. It was salt and sugar, not pepper. That was salt's opposite. And I'm not even sure she was right on that, because I'm not sure if saltness and sweetness are opposite ends of a spectrum. It might be saltness and saltiness and bitterness. I'm not sure. But anyway, that got me thinking back then and today. And then someone else called out chocolate and vanilla as opposites, and she accepted that. That was fine. And that got me sort of outraged, because at the time I was a chocolate fanatic and lover, but I was also a baker. I loved to bake. And I knew that they weren't opposites, but chocolate and vanilla were more like colleagues or coworkers, because vanilla enhanced chocolate. You needed vanilla to make chocolate taste good. And so that sort of got me enraged and got me thinking. And then around that same time, too, I used to always get pissed off. I was an angry kid. When we were in the lunch line and we'd be, you know, buying our little lunches, and there was always those little containers of milk, and the milk choices were chocolate milk or plain unflavored milk. But there was always some dumb kid who would say, I don't want chocolate milk, I want vanilla milk, because vanilla was implied by the whiteness. The whiteness of the milk implied vanilla-ness, not plain, not unflavored. His brain couldn't process that. It was like, well, if it's not chocolate, it's vanilla. It was vanilla milk. And I used to go, it's not vanilla, you moron. It's just unflavored milk. It's white. It's plain. It's not vanilla milk. Angry again. Now, you know, I could have actually saved a lot of money and time wasted on 4 years of college if somebody at that point had just like plucked me off that lunch line and sat me down and said, okay, we know what you are meant to do now, and sat me down at this table in front of this mic and just let me start talking back then. Because here I am still ranting about the same things, and I had to spend all that money and time going to college when here I am and I did something completely unrelated. So anyway, this whole vanilla theme kind of started going through my head after my student telling me about just wanting her coffee, plain coffee, unflavored coffee, which doesn't imply vanilla-ness. And in that kind of strange and coincidental way that my life tends to be, on that same day, more and more vanilla occurrences started happening. It was very strange. I got an email from a former colleague of mine, another instructor, who left teaching where I work and went to Dubai. He got a really big job offer in Dubai to help start up a culinary school in Dubai. And so he's helping them to like find the location and build the building and source all the equipment and write curriculum and all that. And we were emailing back and forth to each other about stuff, mostly just gossip, work gossip stuff. And then he asked me if I knew of some sort of substitute for vanilla extract, because he can't use it there. He can't put it in the curriculum. The reason you can't use vanilla extract in Dubai, of course, is because it's got alcohol in it. And Dubai is in the United Arab Emirates, and they're not allowed to consume any alcohol. Now, if you have a restaurant or a hotel or something and you cater to foreigners, that's fine. You can serve alcohol. But if you're teaching a school in Dubai for locals, no alcohol. And he had actually brought some vanilla extract with him, I'm not sure why, along with a collection of various wine vinegars. And all of it was confiscated when he got there. They took away his vanilla. They took away his wine vinegar. There are other vinegars you can use there, but if they actually have the word wine on the label, no can do in the UAE. You can't use them. They also confiscated his supply of New Mexico chili powders, which I thought was weird too. But that has nothing to do with alcohol. That probably has to do with their fear of bugs and invasive species being brought in with agricultural products. It's how most of our most worst invasive species have gotten here through ag products. So it's not surprising. But anyway, back to the vanilla. So I suggested to Alan that he use vanilla powder or vanilla paste, which are both products that are actual vanilla made from the vanilla bean, but don't contain alcohol and work just as well as the extract. And in that heat out there, they're probably more stable because they won't evaporate because of the alcohol. Well, the paste, I looked it up. It turns out it does have alcohol in it, but the powder doesn't. And it turns out that's what he's been using all along. So why did he even bother to ask me and waste my time? I don't know. But maybe he thought I would have like some other secret source or some magic bean or access to some information that he didn't have. But turns out I didn't. I said use vanilla powder. So then back at work, after the iced coffee flavoring discussion that I had with the student, we started the day's lesson. And now we're working on Italian regional right now in their class. And so that day we were covering the foods of northeastern Italy, places like Venice and Friuli and Trentino and those places. Now that's kind of a funny little part of Italy because it bumps right up against Slovenia and Austria, but you also have Venice and the Gulf of Venice there. And so you have this kind of weird mix of like Slavic influences. You're next to Slovenia. You have this weird like kind of Alpine Tyrolean influence because you're right up there next to Austria. But then you slope down to like the, you know, sea level floodplains of Venice. And that's kind of all in one little corner of the country. So it's really like a weird place. And so I was telling my students about the foods of Venice and how guys from Venice, like Marco Polo, famous Venetian, the explorers, would depart from Venice, from the Gulf of Venice. You know, they were funded by the money from the Renaissance, basically. And they would go east from Venice and they would, you know, rape and plunder and pillage and steal and all in the name of finding exotic spices and flavorings and, of course, gold to bring back to their patrons in Europe. The spices were really what it was all about. At that time, spices were more valuable than anything in Europe. And the Venetians loved the exotic flavors and of the spices that were coming back in with Marco Polo and all his cohorts, co-explorers. And the Venetians actually started incorporating those flavors into their cuisine. Now, spices, like I said, were like the bling of the Age of Exploration. The more you had, the more you would show them off in your cooking. So, you know, they were like the Kardashians of their time as far as spices. They, you know, more and more and better and more, just pile it on. So the more you had, the more you would kind of show off, at least in the Veneto. But this was really unusual for Italy because Italian cuisine in general, it doesn't rely on complex spicing at all. It's really more about stripping away and simplicity than piling it on. And just across the top of Italy, that little narrow area at the top where you have Genoa on the other side of Italy, the Genovese were taking those spices from those Venetian merchants, using them to fund their explorations and their sailing trips and getting rid of them. They were taking them out to sea and using them as commodities because they said, well, we're Genovese and we grow all this great basil and we have all our own herbs and we don't need your stinking spices. We're going to use them as money. And they never incorporated them into their food. So it's kind of a funny little balance there between the Venetians and their spices and the Genovese and their herbs. But anyway, back to those Venetians. So to illustrate how they incorporated these exotic spices in their cuisines, one of the dishes we make in that lesson is a green bean dish where we saute little haricot vert, little green beans with vanilla, of course, because that's what we're talking about today. Yeah, vanilla. So it's a dish made of little green beans cooked in this kind of aromatic base of shallots and celery and pork fat. And then you added a little bit of tomato. And then at the end, you add a little drop of vanilla. And the recipe says to use a half a teaspoon of vanilla, which is way, way, way too much. I have them add it like a drop of vanilla at a time. Otherwise, it winds up tasting like green bean vanilla pudding, like way too desserty. You're using the vanilla in like a savory way, not in a dessert, so it should be subtle. It's there to provide kind of a mystery, like a mysterious fragrance and flavor, but not so much so that it tastes like a cupcake. It's sort of how people should approach the use of perfume, but they don't. Where you leave the slightest mysterious hint of it in the air, you don't make people choke from it. Anyway, so we made this dish, this fagiolini dish with vanilla, and people tasted it, and some people liked it. It's an interesting dish. I wouldn't say it's delicious, but it's an interesting dish. It's an interesting way to use vanilla, and it's a good example of how vanilla can be used as a seasoning and not as a flavoring, where it's not the predominant flavor like in a dessert, but it's simply a seasoning. It's not something I would ever make at home or even really suggest you make, but it's a good learning experience. I would rather just taste the green beans on their own and use the vanilla in something completely different, but it's a good lesson. And then actually in a later unit in the curriculum, we do a recipe from Thomas Keller where we use vanilla beans and saffron together to flavor a sauce for fish. So he does sautéed black sea bass with sauce, and it's like a typical Thomas Keller recipe. It's got like 300 steps to it, but ultimately the results are really good. It just takes you a while. So the first thing he has you do is steam open mussels and pour off all the juice from the mussels and save the juice and then pitch the mussels. Like he says, save them for another use. So usually I just eat them at that point. Then you take that mussel stock and you add vanilla beans to it and saffron and the pods from the vanilla, and you let that cook down and reduce it down till it's like a gloss, till it's like syrup. And then you add cream, reduce that down, and then you mount it with butter, which means you add in little bits of butter and whisk them in gradually until it emulsifies, like if you were making a beurre blanc. And then that gets served with this crispy sea bass and parsnip puree. And it's actually really, truly, like, totally delicious. Totally delicious. It's a great combination, the saffron and the vanilla with the fish. Sounds like it would be really odd, but it's actually really good. I once ate lobster that had a vanilla sauce with it also, and it was good, but it was like a little overkill. It was like rich lobster with sweet, and it was too much. Personally, I'm not so into that, and I think that maybe like my people originally who were not Italian, although there is some thought that Jews come from Northern Italy, but if they were, they were probably Jews from Genoa, Genovese Jews, herb loving, not necessarily the spice loving kind. I mean, I love spices, but this whole idea of vanilla with green beans, it doesn't really cut it for me. Anyway, we're going to take a very short break right now, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the actual vanilla orchid and like what it does and how it grows and how vanilla is produced. And then we'll take a little visit to a beaver dam. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. Remember that you can always find any Heritage Radio show on iTunes. They are all there, all for you, all free for the podcasting. You can also listen to any of them on the Heritage Radio Network website. And you can also become a fan of Why We Cook on Facebook. And you can follow me on Twitter at Chef Smarty Pants. Chef Smarty Pants is my alter ego. So we were talking about vanilla and using it in savory applications. And also earlier in the show, we've been talking about how plain and vanilla have sort of become synonymous. Like vanilla is the default flavor, which it's not. It's a flavor, but it's not the plain flavor. still a little angry about that whole milk issue back in fourth grade. So, and also I was talking about the vanilla plant. And remember I said how hard it must be to be a vanilla plant? Well, let me tell you, it isn't all long sunny days in the tropics. Well, actually, it is all about long sunny days in the tropics. Vanilla can only grow within 10 to 20 degrees of the equator. So forget about it, like Brooklyn homesteaders getting all excited. You know, you want to grow your own vanilla. You can't do it. Stick to the kale and the chickens. You can grow your own hops. Hops grow around here. I was just talking to somebody about growing my own hops. But can't grow it here. So the other crazy thing about vanilla is that it's a hermaphroditic plant. It's got both. It's got the male and the female gonads in it, which is kind of interesting. But it can't self-pollinate. For some reason, it evolved not to self-pollinate. So in order to be pollinated, it has to be pollinated by a bee. Yay, the bees. A special bee that is specifically evolved to pollinate the vanilla orchid. The male and female organs in that vanilla orchid are separated by a membrane. It keeps the male and female apart. In my mind, it's sort of like a little Hasidic wedding going on inside that vanilla orchid. Men on one side, women on the other side. Keep those genders separate. Otherwise, something crazy would happen, like self-pollinization. We don't want that to happen. So anyway, this bee pollinates the orchid in Mexico, where it's native to. Vanilla is native to Mexico, and the bee is native to Mexico. And that's where it came from. But when other people figured out how delicious it was and how great it was and how valuable it was, they brought vanilla plants to other countries, but they could not get the bee to live in the other countries. They tried to import the bees, but the bees did not want to leave Mexico. Cannot blame them. So years ago on the island of Reunion in French Polynesia, they were growing vanilla and trying to figure out how to pollinate the flowers. And lo and behold, a 12-year-old French slave on Reunion Island figured it out. He figured out that you could take a little sliver of bamboo and tap the pollen from one side on it and slide it into the other side. And that's how commercial vanilla cultivation took off. However, the orchids only bloom one night a year. They bloom once every 12 months. And they only stay open for about 12 hours. So when you're in pollinating mode, you actually have to stay there and constantly watch your plants for those orchid blossoms to open. Because as soon as they open, you have to get in there, pollinate, and get out. You got to do your business. It's like artificial insemination. You have to time it right, like waiting for that little ovulation stick to tell you it's time. It's the same thing. Very labor intensive. That's why vanilla is so expensive, because you get one shot a year to pollinate. And then the flower develops the pod, and then the pod has to be harvested, and then the pod has to be dried and fermented and processed, and takes a long time. Now, of course, if you don't want to spend the money on expensive vanilla, good vanilla, there's always artificial vanilla flavoring. Now, when I was little and I loved to bake, my mother would get mad because I would use up all the good vanilla extract, so she would buy artificial vanilla extract, which I hated using because it wasn't as good. Now, artificial vanilla is made from two different things. The one you're probably familiar with is something called vanillin. Vanillin. You know where vanillin comes from? Vanillin is a byproduct of paper making. It comes from wood pulp. Yes, it's from wood pulp. Now, I guess wood is a plant. Technically, you're dealing with something edible, but it's a byproduct chemical of paper making from wood pulp. It sounds really tasty. I don't really want to eat that. But even better than vanillin is something called castoreum. Now, castoreum is also a vanilla extract impersonator. And you want to know what castoreum is? Do you really want to know what castoreum is? Because once I tell you, you may get a little sick. Castoreum is an extract made from the castor sacs of beavers. Yes, beavers. Vanilla and some artificial raspberry too. Artificial flavoring. Artificial raspberry, artificial vanilla. Some come from the glands that are on a beaver right underneath its tail. Basically between its like pelvis and its tail. You know where I'm talking about? So those glands are taken out of the beaver and aged for 2 years to let them mellow out. And then the castoreum is removed and used as a flavoring in food. It's also used a lot in perfume, and it's also used in cigarette making to give cigarettes a more pleasant flavor. So as if smoking a cigarette wasn't disgusting and toxic enough, you're also inhaling vaporized beaver gland ass juice. Yeah. Pretty gross, right? And it's used a lot. But you'll never see it listed on labels as beaver ass extract because the FDA says that it can be listed as a natural flavoring. So you know when you look at a product and it says natural flavoring? Well, one of those natural flavorings is beaver ass juice in your vanilla flavored pudding snack because they don't use real vanilla in that. So think about that. Think about it when you're in the store and you're shopping and you want to buy the real vanilla, but you want to cheap out. Maybe you're going to buy the fake vanilla. Don't do it. Wood pulp and beaver ass. That's what you're getting. And the next time you're getting a coffee and you're cheaping out and you're thinking about maybe I'll go to McDonald's instead of like a good coffee place, like my local fair trade sustainable coffee place, think twice before you get a flavor added to your coffee. Remember to ask for plain. Specify unflavored, just coffee flavored, and tell them to hold the beaver. So that's just about it. We're out of time. Hope I didn't make you too sick with that last thought. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week with an all-new show. And thanks to Carlos in the control room. And have a good night.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. The long-awaited documentary The Vanishing of the Bees will be screening in Astoria, Queens at the Broadway branch of the Queens Public Library on Monday, September 19th. I know that seems like a long ways away, but it isn't. It will be broadcast from 6 to 8 p.m. More information about this fascinating look at bee life and colony collapse disorder can be found at their website at www.vanishingbees.com. I also wanted to add that the producers are all working on a 30-minute educational video for high school students, so any parent or teacher should check out the site to see what he or she can do to work with the team to bring this into a school curriculum. The film has a Facebook page as well that discusses current events that affect bees. This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.